If you are a junior high person, I'll give you a moment to slip out to your class, and you can give our regards to the children that we are aware of as well this morning. And if you're here past the junior high cutoff, you can turn with me to Ephesians chapter 3 as we take this fourth look at experiencing the greatness of God, and this morning particularly look at knowing the greatness of God's wisdom by experience. Knowing God's great wisdom by experience. And let me say at the beginning, if this is old hat to you, then I just remind you, if this doesn't sound quite right to you, then I'd ask you at least to take my word for it until we get through the scriptures that we look at today, and perhaps then you'll see it's true. Let me say to you that when we talk about the wisdom of God, when we're talking about wisdom, we're talking about a very practical thing. We're not talking about anything other than how to live. Wisdom is how to live. You can use the word knowledge as a synonym to wisdom, but understand you'd be meaning the knowledge of how to get through life. You can use understanding as a synonym, but we're talking about understanding how life works. Wisdom is knowing how to live. And now we look at God's great wisdom by experience. Now, last week we considered the fact that getting to know any aspect of God's character by experience can be compared to climbing a mountain. And you can walk around the base of the mountain and look up at different faces of the mountain as you can look at the character of God from different angles and see different aspects of God's character and consider climbing up the mountain, that is getting to know the greatness of that aspect of God's character. And we should consider that at the part of the mountain where we're facing the wisdom of God, there are warning signs posted. There's all kinds of declarations on signs that we can see. This is Bible verses that say, don't be thinking you're going to get to the top of the mountain this way. There are warnings that the wisdom of God is so much greater than ours that we don't have a hope of getting up to the top of the mountain. In actual fact, we can't get to the top of the mountain of the knowledge of God on any face, but there are warnings about wisdom. And let's look at a couple of them as we start. Isaiah 40, verse 28, we've already seen in this great chapter about the power of God. Isaiah says, "Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth." Now, this is a chapter about the power of God, and the power of God ought to be showing up in our lives so that things don't go badly. And yet sometimes it seems like the power of God is failing us. And one temptation is to think maybe God is failing us. So Isaiah says, "He does not faint or grow weary." You are not suffering because God is running out of steam. He's not getting weak in regard to helping you. That's not the problem. But the problem is with your understanding, because look at his understanding is unsearchable. And here in this chapter, but the power of God, we're being told that God's understanding is something beyond our understanding. His understanding is unsearchable. So it might look like he's too faint to help. It might look like he's getting tired of helping, but that's not it at all. It's just that we don't understand because his understanding is so much higher than ours. And if that's not clear enough, then in Isaiah 55, God himself speaks up. He says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." This is the very same thing that David says in Psalm 139, that wonderful psalm about God's omniscience and God's omnipresence. He's everywhere, and he knows everything. He knows when we sit down and when we stand up. He knows our thoughts from afar. He knows our thoughts even before they enter our minds. And David says in verse 6, "Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain it." And these are the signposts at the bottom of the mountain saying you're going to climb up this face of the mountain. You're going to try to experience the wisdom of God, get to know the wisdom of God. Be warned, it's really a high mountain, and you're not going to be able to understand the understanding of God because his understanding is high above ours. His understanding is unsearchable. Now, our particular text is Ephesians chapter 3. And Paul the Apostle talks about the wisdom of God. Starting at verse 8, he says, "To me, Paul the Apostle, to me, though I am the very least of all the saints, this grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ and to bring to light for everyone what is the plan of the mystery hidden for ages in God who created all things." So that, he's preaching the gospel, this mysterious gospel, so that through the church, the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. Having explained that the wisdom of God is far beyond us, we are served notice that what God is doing for us as the church, what God has in mind for us as the people of the church, is a display of his wisdom. And it's a present display we see in verse 10 as well. So, what we have to deal with this morning, and what we in fact ought to do more than deal with, what we ought to learn to delight in, is that God's ways are so far above us that we're never really going to understand all of what God is doing in the world and in the church and in our own lives. Even in our own lives, we will not become experts at knowing what God is doing because his wisdom is so far above ours. And you could say, you know, as you think about trying to get your mind around this fact that you're never going to know everything God is doing, you could say, well, what did you expect? I mean, we're talking about God here. We're not talking about the head of the class. We're not talking about the smartest one among us. We're talking about the God who created the universe. You know, if you need to, go borrow a telescope and have a good look at the universe. And then borrow a microscope and have a good look at what's going on, you know, among the cells of your body. And if that's not, you know, helpful enough, then ask someone. Ask someone who understands astronomy or ask someone who understands biochemistry. And they'll tell you something of how complicated and mysterious the plain obvious things of the world are. You look at the sun or you look at the stars and you might think you understand, but someone with a really good telescope and the knowledge of how to use a good telescope could tell you, no, you can't possibly understand what's going on there. And the same is true about the cells in our body and the life functions and so on. We are complicated people living in a complicated universe. It's God who created us. It's God who created it. So of course we don't understand what's going on. Why did we think we could? The big idea this morning is just this, that we, the people of Christ, the people who love him and are called according to his purpose, are not wise enough and never will be in this age to understand the wisdom of God. That sounds like a bit of a downer, doesn't it? You just never will understand. Like, you just never will get it. But it's an important point to comprehend because it has big implications to how we live life and how we worship God. So here are some notes on the subject of the fact that we, the people of Christ, are not wise enough to understand the wisdom of God. Three notes, and the first one is given as a review of what we've seen so far, looking at other aspects of the knowledge of God. Here's the first note. Every detail of the life of every one of us people of Christ, every detail of the life of every one of us people of Christ is always about us becoming more Christ-like and more fruitful, and about our lives in the coming ages displaying the kindness of God. We know this from what we've seen already. I hope you have this firmly intact, in place in your mind, that whatever else can't be understood about what's going on in your life, you should understand this as a person who loves Christ and seeks to follow him, a person whose faith is placed in Christ, that whatever's going on in your life is about making you more Christ-like, it's about making you more productive or fruitful as a follower of Christ, and it's about displaying the kindness of God. This we saw last week. And listen, if someone wants to say, this sounds pretty, you know, kind of person-centered, man-centered, anthropocentric, this sounds kind of like not very theologically sound, because you might say, I know that in fact everything's about the glory of God, so what about that? I would say, you know, thanks for sharing, that's true. But what you need to understand is that everything being about the glory of God, your life is what it is, because God is choosing to glorify himself by making you more Christ-like. God is choosing to glorify himself by making you more fruitful. God is choosing to glorify himself by displaying his great kindness to you. So we're not contradicting the idea that everything that exists is for the glory of God. We're just getting to the details of how your existence is meant to glorify God. Your Christ-likeness, your fruitfulness, and the kindness of God showing up in your details, that is the glory of God. That is what God is doing with you to bring glory to his name. And I want you to notice one other thing, since Ephesians 2:7 is up there as the final text of note 1. Ephesians 2:7 is what we saw last week. You might have your Bible open there, and you can see that this display of the kindness of God in our lives, maybe you remember this from last week, the fact that your life is a display of the kindness of God is something that isn't actually applying to this age. It's for the coming age. You see how it says that in verse 7? It says that in the coming ages, God might show the immeasurable riches of his grace in kindness toward us in Christ Jesus. This is a review of last week. The ways in which the details of your life display the kindness of God is part of a display God plans for the future, for the coming ages. So if it doesn't look like kindness right now, that God is letting things go on in your life, that are going on in your life, you need to be patient. It'll all look like the kindness of God in the coming ages. Now contrast that future display of the kindness of God to what we see in Ephesians 3:10. There is a present display of the wisdom of God in all of us. And God's manifold wisdom is being made known now, present time, in this age, through the church. But on the other hand, the display of his wisdom now is not for here, it's for there. You see what it says in verse 10? It says, through the church, the manifold wisdom of God might now be made known. Okay, good, something's clear. The wisdom now is made known, but it's not known to us. It's made known to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. There are supernatural beings who are somehow in our time experience. They're not on earth, they're in the heavenly places, however we are to understand that. And they're seeing what God is doing through us. They're seeing what God is doing in the church, and they are able to benefit from what God is doing through us because it helps them understand his wisdom. But this doesn't mean that it looks like the wisdom of God to us necessarily. And that brings us back to our big idea, that we down here in the present time and on earth are not able to understand the wisdom of God because we're not wise enough. Now, on to the second note. Here are a couple of other reasons why we can't understand, even hope to understand, the wisdom of God in our lives. Here's note two. How the details of our lives now display the great wisdom of God is beyond our understanding because of the greatness of God's intentions for us. So now this is happy. All of a sudden, it all becomes happy. The reason you can't understand the wisdom of God, though the heavenly beings can understand it, we can't, is because we don't understand his great intentions for us. The fact is, God has got much greater things in mind for us than we can possibly comprehend. So it follows that we're not going to be able to understand his wisdom in taking us down the difficult paths or into the difficulties that he's taken us into. We have to believe that it's his kindness, and we have to believe it's his wisdom, but we're never going to comprehend the wisdom because we can't fathom what great designs God has for us. And maybe you, like I, are old enough and have enough experience to look back on some of the details of your life and begin to get it. So let me do this for you personally. Go back to 1974. You remember 1974? These rows do not understand 1974 at all. Okay, so in 1974, I'm 19 years old, and there's one hardship in my life. I haven't told Deb I'm telling this story. In 1974, I have one hardship in this life. I'm crazy about my girlfriend, and she's losing interest. So this is bad. I think I'm losing the account. Oh, no. So I think to do something, I thought of a lot of things to do, but one frivolous thing I thought to do to try to kind of win her back, you know, to thinking that I was someone worth dating, was I wrote her a children's story. It was meant to warm her heart and endear her to me, as you know, the kind of guy who'd be an ideal father of small children. So I write a children's story. And in 1974, the summer of 1974, our relationship gets so shaky that I don't send it to her. And if you ask me what was going on, you know, why this was happening to me, why this, you know, girl was losing interest in me, and why things were so bad that I didn't even dare send her this children's story, I would have guessed wrong. Well, then into my life comes another girl, and she makes it obvious that she would be willing to fill the position of girlfriend. Now, I need to make it very clear, you know, because of who's here tonight, that I never had any interest in her being my girlfriend. But I did talk to her in a church foyer after a service and explained to her that this last week I'd written a children's story. And she explained to me that she had written a short story a while ago and got published in a magazine. Now, I had absolutely no interest in her as a potential girlfriend, but I had some sort of interest in her story about getting published. So we spent a little time together. I had time on my hands because my girlfriend wasn't really very interested in doing stuff. And she explained to me what she did to get published. So I sent this little story off to a publisher. And while I was waiting to hear back from them, I wrote another short story. And when I got the rejection slip from the publisher about the first story, I decided not to give up. And I sent, not the first story, but the second story, off to another publisher. because I'd learned how to do this, because this girl I met, because my girlfriend was not paying any attention to me. And the second publishing company sent me a contract to publish that second story. So I had no idea at the time how unusual this was. I thought, hey, cool. And I sent the first manuscript off, the first one I'd written for Deb, and they accepted that too. Later on, I came to see how stunningly unlikely it was that I would dash off a couple of stories for children at the age of 19 and get them both published, but I did. And I was ecstatically excited about those contracts because I thought that in the wisdom of God, He had decided to turn me into a rich, famous author of children's books as a way of winning the attention of this girl who was losing interest. And I was totally wrong about that. But if God was the sort of God who came to us in our circumstances and said what He had in mind and gave me a choice, I would have said yes if this was His choice, you know, to turn me into a children's author. It didn't work like that. The relationship with Deb was salvaged, and the books got published. And the long and short of it is that when I graduated with a degree in English literature a few years later from Queen's University, I was the only student graduating with an English degree that had a degree-related job to go to, because that publishing company gave me a job in their editorial department. I'd gotten to know them through the publication of those two books. I was the guy with the job. Every other graduate from English degrees at Queen's University in 1977 went to teacher's college or to graduate school or bought a knapsack and went to Europe. But I was the guy with the job, which was really helpful because it helped me convince her father to let me marry her. And I did. So then I was in publishing. And if you had asked me what was God doing, I would have said, God used that bad summer of 1974 to get me set up in publishing, and also perhaps to make me a rich and famous children's author. Well, I was wrong about all of that. But those details and the fact that I moved to that town to work in that publishing company had everything to do with me at the age of 30 in 1984, 10 years later, moving to London to become the pastor of this church. And I wanted you to know clearly that I consider it an enormous privilege, one of the enormous privileges of my life, to be entitled, to be honored to pastor a church, especially for such a long time. No kidding, this is honestly me. After all these years of being here, I would rather be me than Dr. Seuss. This is better than being a world-famous, rich children's author. I think it really is. But if at any point in the story, you know, the 10 years from 74, the bad summer, to 84, moving to London to become the pastor of this church, I had an opportunity to check with God and vote on what the details of my life should amount to, I think I would have voted wrong. I think I would have guessed wrong. And the fact is, the point is, I had no way of knowing what God was doing and how that bad summer and this girlfriend who seemed hard to please was an instrumental part of my life by which I became the pastor of this church. Go figure. So I'm telling you all this to say, you know, note two, how the details of our lives now display the great wisdom of God is beyond our understanding because of the greatness of God's intentions for us. And the illustration is simply saying, from my point of view, it's a greater thing to be the pastor of a church than to be a children's author. Though, you know, if any of you are world-famous children's authors here this morning, yeah, my hat off to you. It's a great thing, too. But I'm glad I'm the pastor of the church, and I got to be the pastor of the church through this strange set of circumstances. But, you know, if I had picked it, you know, and I picked it in a way that now looks wrong, it would have been very typical of our nature because we tend to shoot low. Some of us have high hopes, and some of us aren't so optimistic. But even the people with high hopes tend to hope for the wrong sorts of things. This is just the sort of people we are. So when Paul the Apostle is talking about the wisdom of God, he serves warning that we need to brace ourselves, that God in His wisdom is planning much greater things than we can possibly imagine. He does this, for example, in Ephesians chapter 2. He's talking in Ephesians chapter 2 about the wisdom of God. He's done so in chapter 1 as well. But look at what he says about the wisdom of God in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. All right, starting in verse 1, here's Paul the Apostle on the subject of wisdom. I'm going to read down to verse 10. Paul says, "And I, when I came to you, brothers, did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom. I didn't come with great wisdom, for I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling, and my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith might not rest on the wisdom of men, but on the power of God. He's saying, I didn't come with wisdom. I'm not in the business of communicating wisdom. The gospel's not a message of wisdom. Quite the opposite. From the world's perspective, it's a message of foolishness. There is no wisdom driving me, he says. And then he changes the page, so to speak, and talks positively about wisdom. He says, yet among the mature, we do impart wisdom, although it's not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are doomed to pass away. But we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. There's a secret and hidden wisdom. He says in verse 8, none of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, here it comes, what no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him, these things God has revealed to us through the Spirit. The wisdom of God, the spiritual wisdom of God, pertains to things that our eyes have never seen, that our ears have never heard, that our hearts have never imagined. These are the things that God has prepared for those who love him. So no wonder we get it wrong whenever we take a guess at what God might be doing in our lives, what wise things he's got in mind for us. We tend to shoot low. Even when we have high hopes, our high hopes are too low compared to what God has in store for us, what God means to do for us. Our eyes have never seen it. Our ears have never heard it. Our heart has never imagined the sorts of things that God has in mind for us. So it follows that we can't understand what God is doing in our lives right now. For example, right now, November 2008, because he's got such high and immeasurably glorious plans for us. And some of us, you know, are just not the sort to plan so high, to think so high, to imagine ourselves being used or attaining to anything so glorious. So we set our sights low and then wonder why things aren't working out the way we wanted. But we want things that are too low. This is like that famous C.S. Lewis sermon, right? Lewis was a writer, not a preacher, but he preached a couple sermons, and his most famous sermon is The Weight of Glory, and hear these famous words, perhaps you know them already. Lewis says, if we consider the unblushing promises of reward and the staggering nature of the rewards promised in the Gospels, it would seem that our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures, fooling about with drink and sex and ambition, when infinite joy is offered to us. Like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. Lewis says, very famously, I think, we are far too easily pleased. And I wonder if you, like me, want to plead guilty to that. That's true. Far too easily pleased. Way too much of a hobbit. I just want a nice little hole with a round door and a garden out front to sit and, you know, look at the day going by. We are so easily pleased. But God has lofty goals for us. God has big things in mind for us. And so he takes us down difficult paths and mysterious paths and paths that have strange, you know, sharp turns, because he's got things in mind for us that we can never figure out. Though perhaps we live long enough to look back and see some of the wisdom of God in taking some of the details of our lives and doing some of the glorious things he has in mind. But it ain't over till it's over. So here's one of the reasons why we can't understand, one of the happy reasons why we can't understand the wisdom of God, because he's got such highfalutin plans for us. He's got such glorious plans for us. And note three is the other reason why the details of our lives being driven by the wisdom of God is beyond our understanding. Here's note three. It's all beyond our understanding because the stories of our lives are so interconnected. And you got to see that too, that whatever happens to you will have a lifelong impact on some people. And even small things in your lives can have a life-changing impact upon some people who you realize are totally connected to you, and some people who you don't even know, but who will be impacted by what goes on in your life. We looked last week at Mary, who heard that she was going to be the mother of Jesus. And she said, behold, the servant of the Lord, let it be to me according to his word. And then she said the words we call the Magnificat, a poem or a psalm that she wrote upon the occasion of knowing about this great honor that was being given to her. She says in Luke chapter 1, My soul magnifies the Lord. She is a making known the greatness of God woman. She says, my soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has looked on the humble estate of his servant. For behold, from now on, all generations will call me blessed, for he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. Now, she had some special insight here, right? She's dictating the Bible, but her insight was right. She said, the great things that God is doing for me are so great that it won't just impact me, it will impact other people. And she actually had the insight to see it will impact all generations from now on. Every generation of the human race is going to be impacted by the great things God is doing for me. She's an extreme case of an interconnected life, but it's a good illustration of how what's going on in our lives will have an impact, according to the wisdom of God, in the lives of others. And then she sort of gets on a roll. She says, for behold, from now on, all generations will call me blessed, for he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name, and his mercy is for those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of humble estate. He's filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent empty away. And this is Mary, young Mary. She's what, a teenager? She's 14 or 15 years old. She's been given this great honor, which is going to pack with it a great disgrace as well. For being an unwed mother in those days would create a great disgrace in her life and in her family. But she knew that her own life, all the glories and all the shames, were, by the wisdom of God, interconnected with what God was doing to, well, the people she talked about, the proud, who he's scattering, the mighty, who he's bringing down, the humble, who he's exalting, the hungry, who he's filling, the rich, who he's sending empty away. Her life was interconnected with all sorts of other lives. So that what God was doing to her, the great things God had in mind for her, were his goodness in his wisdom to many other people as well. And we have considered Job recently as well. And there's Job in his misery at a sort of breaking point in regard to the frustration he has with the so-called wisdom of his friends. He gets sarcastic in chapter 12. Job says, no doubt you are the people. And wisdom will die with you, he says to his friends. This is sarcastic. He says, you guys are the market cornered on wisdom. He says, but I have understanding as well. I'm not inferior to you. Who does not know such things as these? And then he tells them things that he thinks should be obvious to them but are not. He talks about the animals. He says, go to the animals and ask them, or go to the fish and ask them. Go to the bushes of the earth and ask them. He says in verse 9, who among all these, the beasts and the birds and the fish and the bushes, does not know what you should know, that the hand of the Lord has done this. In his hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. God has the whole world in his hands. And then he begins to talk about the sorts of things that are going on because of what's going on in his life. He says, with God are wisdom and might. He has counsel and understanding. If he tears down, none can rebuild. If he shuts a man in, none can open. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the land. With him are strength, there's the power of God, and sound wisdom. The deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away, stripped, and judges he makes fools. He looses the bonds of kings and binds a waistcloth on their hips. He leads priests away, stripped, and overthrows the mighty. What Job is saying, in his great frustration that his friends don't understand, is that his life, all the glories and all the griefs, and the griefs were great, all the pleasures, and they're all in his past now, and all the pains, and his pains were severe, they all had to do not only with the wisdom of God in regard to his life and the great things he had in store for him, but they had to do with the wisdom of God in regard to the people he talks about here, the deceived and the deceiver. The counselors and the judges and the kings and the priests, all these people whose lives are impacted by what God is doing in the life of one poor guy who's going through these hard times that he can't possibly understand, illustrate to us that one of the other reasons why we can't understand the wisdom of God is that our lives are so mysteriously interconnected to other lives, and God has equally wise and glorious plans for other people, and has the freedom and the right and the kindness to use us to impact those people, that we're beat before we start it trying to understand why the details of our life are what they are right now. His ways are far above ours, and we cannot understand his ways. So there's Mary, and there's Job, and then there's you with the life that you're living here in southwestern Ontario in November of 2008, unless you're visiting from out of province, wherever you are, your life, there's you. And your life is obviously interconnected to some other lives, right? The people that you are connected to, like your family and your best friends and the people you work with. And your lives will become interconnected. You know this from experience. Your lives will become interconnected to some people that you haven't met yet. And depending on what God does with you and the role that he's written you into his story with, it might be people that you never meet who are dramatically affected by what God does for you next. But the fact is that all kinds of people will be affected by what God does for you and what he doesn't do for you. And the fact that he's going to give you some of the things you hope for. And he's going to give you some of the things that you fear. And he's going to keep you from some of the things that you hope for. And he's going to keep you from some of the things you fear. He's working out a plan. And he's got high and lofty goals for you as a person. And we know they have to do with your Christ-likeness, and they have to do with your productivity, and they have to do with his kindness. But we don't know what else they have to do with, because his ways are past ours, past our understanding. But it also has to do with what he's doing through you to other people. And there are lots of cases you can start thinking about the ways in which somebody's life has impacted other people's lives, not always because of the good things, sometimes because of the bad things. Think of 1956, think of Jim Elliot, one of the five American missionaries, speared to death in the jungles of Ecuador. And you know, after that, I mean, obviously his death had a huge impact upon his young widow and their daughter and the rest of the Elliot family. But you know that after 1956, when those five missionaries were speared to death trying to preach the gospel to the natives of the jungles in Ecuador, there was a huge surge in enrollment among young adults for overseas missionary service, like a huge surge of missionaries. So all kinds of people went to the mission field because five guys got speared to death. And that was all part of the interconnectedness, although it was people that Jim Elliot never met, whose lives were changed, whose life direction was reversed, whose lives were impacted by something God chose to do, to have happen to one particular person. And we are living the same sort of drama, probably not in such spectacular terms, but in the very same way, God is using the details of our lives because he's got designs for us and through us to other people. It's what Paul says to the Corinthians, quoting from the Old Testament, "What no eye has seen, nor ear heard, nor the heart of man imagined, what God has prepared for those who love him." So we need to think this through. What's going on in our lives means a whole lot about what God is doing for us and what God is doing through us to other people. So what do we do with this? Well, we're beat before we start in terms of understanding the wisdom of God, and yet the Bible has a very clear call upon our lives to be as wise as we can be. So what do we do about this? What's the action? Two actions I can think of this morning for you to chew away on this week and get started on. Action A, begin to be wise by wholeheartedly revering God, by reverencing God with your whole heart. Your reverence for him needs to be so intense that no other word will do but fear. For in the Proverbs we read that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. This is a very important principle. We have not begun to be wise. Remember what we said at the beginning. Wisdom is how to live. We have not begun to understand how to live until our reverence for God reaches the pitch of fear, until we're trembling before God in his greatness. So what do we do about the wisdom of God? We begin to imitate it. We begin to be wise by working on our wholehearted reverence for God. This, as it turns out, is kind of the whole point of the Job story. From Job's perspective, God had lots in mind in regard to the difficulties Job went through, but what he had in mind for Job was, I think, to bring him to a point he gets to in what we call chapter 42. Look at Job. Here's a man who's learned to fear the Lord. He says to God, after he's spoken to those friends a lot, he says, "I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge?" He says, "Therefore, I've uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know." He says, "Hear and I will speak." He says to God, "Hear and I will speak. I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you, by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I despise myself, and I repent in dust and ashes. And that's kind of the punchline of the whole story from Job's perspective. God took him through some very hard times to get in the place where he repents, where he changes his mind about what his life's about, and about who's in charge of his life, and about who's the wise one, and about who should answer the questions. He says, I despise myself. He says, I hate myself for the role I played in this drama about me. As I come to understand, it's not about what I want for me, it's about what you want for me. Maybe we can be excused if we've grown up in functional homes. We start off our lives thinking we are the center of the universe by our parents' devotion to us. And some of us live the rest of our lives never getting that mistake corrected. But God's intention is to correct the mistake and to see that we are not the center of the universe, that God is at the center of the universe, and he's using our lives wisely and kindly to accomplish his purposes in our lives and in the lives of others. And when we begin to fear God, when we begin to reverence God that wholeheartedly, we begin to be wise because we begin to get the point that God means for us to gladly surrender to his superior wisdom and his infinite kindness, and then begin to live out the details of our lives as the servants of the Lord. So that's the start. That's action A. Here's action B. Once you have begun to be wise, once you have surrendered your expectations and your heart to God, then B, become more and more wise by becoming more and more obedient to God. I began this morning by explaining that wisdom is how to live, and I want to show you that there's a strong component of obedience to the commandments of God in everything it says about wisdom. But that makes sense, because you can't follow Christ without signing on to a life of humble obedience. We saw this last week. Jesus says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. And the cross you take up is the price you pay, the cost of being an obedient follower of Christ. You take up your cross to follow him. And that means that you live your life getting the hang of being obedient to God. That is, you grow more and more wise as you learn to live your life more and more in accordance with his commandments. So in the Proverbs, where we are encouraged to become wise, we're not told to go down to the library and memorize the encyclopedia to get as many facts stored into our head as possible. No, in the Proverbs, when we're told to grow wise, we're told to pay attention to the commandments of God. Look at these texts, Proverbs chapter 2. My son, if you receive my words and treasure up my commandments within you, it's the commandments that we find in his word that we are to treasure, making your ear attentive to wisdom and inclining your heart to understanding. Yes, if you call out for insight and raise your voice for understanding, if you seek it, seek wisdom like silver and search for it as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and will find the knowledge of God, for the Lord gives wisdom. He gives wisdom, but he gives it to those who seek it like silver, search for it as for hidden treasure, and the seeking and the searching comes from the treasuring of his commandments, from learning how to live life in obedience to the commandments of God. The Lord gives wisdom, he says, for from his mouth come knowledge and understanding. He stores up sound wisdom for the upright. He is a shield to those who walk in integrity, guarding the paths of justice and watching over the way of his saints. Then you will understand righteousness and justice and equity, every good path. For wisdom will come into your heart, and knowledge will be pleasant to your soul. The path of wisdom is the path of learning obedience, learning how to obey God in regard to the details of life. Says it all again, over and over again. Here's Proverbs 4. Hear, O sons, a father's instruction, and be attentive that you may gain insight, for I give you good precepts. Do not forsake my teaching. He says, when I was a son with my father, tender, the only one in the sight of my mother, he taught me and said to me, let your heart hold fast my words. Keep my commandments. Keep my commandments and live. Get wisdom. See, keeping my commandments is getting wisdom. He says, get wisdom, get insight. Do not forget and do not turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her and she will keep you. Love her and she will guard you. That is, wisdom will guard you. The beginning of wisdom is this, get wisdom. And whatever you get insight. And the way you get wisdom is by getting more obedient to the commandments of God, more in line with his will for your life morally. Wisdom is a moral state. Wisdom is a moral condition. It's learning how to live. It's about learning to do what's right and learning to refuse to do what's wrong. That's why you see in James, one more text, when James is talking about the difference between the wisdom of the world and the wisdom from above, he describes the wisdom from above in moral terms. He says the wisdom from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, open to reason. It's full of mercy and good fruits. It's impartial and sincere. This is what it means to be wise with the wisdom of God. So my encouragement to you this morning, as you think about devoting this next week to becoming more and more wise, which is a great alternative to living this whole week becoming more and more foolish, right? If you think about devoting this week or all the weeks left of this year to becoming more and more wise, what you ought to do is take stock of the details of your life. And if there is a habit which you should be ashamed of, you should figure out how to break that habit. And if you don't know how to break it, you should go get some help from someone who could give you some ideas on how to break that habit. And if you've got a relationship that's just full of sin, whatever the sin might be, harsh words or unkind thoughts or bad motives or bad business dealings or bad sex or whatever it would be, if you've got a relationship that's bad, you ought to fix that. According to the commandments of God, you ought to learn how to be more pleasing to God in the details of your life and its relationships and all your activities. Because that's the path of wisdom. That's what wisdom is. It starts with the fear of the Lord, and then it goes on as you conform your life to the image of Christ by conforming your life to the principles of His Word, to the commandments of His Word, to wisdom. And that's how you become more and more wise. And the people whose lives are impacted by your lives really hope that this can happen, because the alternative to growing more and more wise is not pleasant for anyone, and it's not good, and it's not happy. But the path of wisdom is pure and peaceable and gentle and reasonable and full of mercy and good fruits. And people will love what God is doing in your life if this is what He's doing in your life, if you grow more wise. And it's all here in the Word. And it's all here by the Spirit. And it's all here to make you more Christ-like and to make you more productive and to display the kindness of God in the coming ages and the wisdom of God right now, though we won't be able to see it while we live here on the earth. This is the will of God. This is the wisdom of God. This is the greatness of His wisdom and what it means to experience it. Let's pray together.